week's edition of World Crisis Radio. This is Webster Tarpley in Washington, D.C. reporting. We have a very busy program today. We want to call your attention to a number of very important themes. First of all, we'll be talking later in the program about the CIA British-backed Jundula terror attacks in Iran this past weekend, almost a week ago now. And if you go to the Russia Today website, the 24-hour cable news service of the Russian government, you will see an interview with yours truly documenting the CIA MI6 support for the Iranian or Baluchistan Sunni terrorist organization Jundula, which is an integral part of the Brzezinski microstates and mini-states strategy. Independent Baluchistan would carve Afghanistan, carve Pakistan, and carve Iran, the breakup of these countries on the agenda, at the top of the agenda. So get that story from me at Russia Today. You can find that at the Russia Today website. Look in under Tarpley. I think they put a headline on it about Al-Qaeda, because in the course of this interview, I referred to Robert Gates, the current boss of the Pentagon, as one of the founders of Al-Qaeda, which he certainly was, in his capacity as deputy director of the CIA. So there's one thing to look at. Another thing, Alex Jones' important new documentary, The Fall of the Republic, the Presidency of Barack H. Obama. This is just released yesterday. I had the honor of being with Alex on his show as he was doing the countdown to the release of this important new documentary. I'll be looking at it and give you more details about it next week. But in the meantime, you can get that from Infowars.com, PrisonPlanet.com, The Fall of the Republic. You want to buy copies, and within the limits of the policy that Alex has, make copies, distribute them, get it out, get it on the scoreboard. Certainly the Obama deception, released back in May of this year, was a turning point in breaking the Obama magic, breaking the hysteria, breaking the media lockstep, and opening up spaces for constructive resistance against Obama. And, of course, most resistance against Obama tends to be constructive, at least if it blocks these nefarious initiatives coming from the Obama regime. We've also got, and I'll be talking to you about this a little bit later, a five-point program on two pages. It's suitable for mass leaflet use. It's in the final stages of editing. I'm going to give you the main points of this. 30 million productive jobs, 30 million new productive jobs for the United States to rebuild infrastructure, rebuild industry and agriculture, the program to end the economic depression here and by implication worldwide. Strong international element in it, but it starts right here with 30 million well-paid productive jobs, union wages, not minimum wage garbage, but living wage jobs under the Davis-Bacon Act, so you get full union pay scales no matter where you are. So that's coming up later on in the program. But now let's turn to something that we've been talking about for a couple of weeks. You'll recall that on the evening of October 5th, 2009, we had this dramatic debate in the Parliament of Iceland, the Althingi in Reykjavik, about this outrageous extortion and blackmail being attempted by the discredited, hated, and moribund Gordon Brown regime in Great Britain and the reactionary Balkenende gang there in The Hague in the Netherlands. They want to extort $6 billion from the 330,000 people of Iceland. And the only answer, of course, is no, nix, nada. And that is the framework for this very important speech. Now, it was a debate called by the Social Democratic and left-green government of Iceland. Social Democrats very negative on all of these main points. They want to pay. They're servile. They grovel. They're just like the Social Democrats in the Weimar Republic who said, yeah, we want to pay the reparations so we can be respectable. Well, You can't be respectable at that price. You can't destroy your country's economic future. So in the context of this, we have the intervention by Birgitte Jonsdottir of the parliamentary faction of The Movement in the Icelandic parliament, October 5th, 2009. This text is up on the Internet. It's been translated, I think, very well into English. This is a real historical document. It is a masterpiece of political and economic reasoning. It also has elements that you could call poetic, even lyric. Let's give you some samples of this. The headlines, of course, being the discussion of the International Monetary Fund, get them out. Debt moratorium, time to consider it, probably time to do it. Tobin tax, time to do it for sure. So she starts off saying, Madam President, dear countrymen, we have a choice to make. You're never faced with one way or one solution. To assert that is a testimony to the incredible tunnel vision on the reality that we live in. We are far from being the first and only nation that has had to deal with crisis and economic collapse. Perhaps what makes our position unique is that we are in an economic war, a war with nations that are using their positions of power to get what they want. Does that mean that all other avenues are closed? Are there perhaps other possibilities than chaining us to the burdens of foreign debt far into the future? And she says, it certainly makes sense to lower our interest rate payments as soon as possible. But is there another way? Why can't we look at, or at least discuss, the possible solution of declaring a debt moratorium? The numbers I hear on the national debt are so huge and such a high percentage of our GDP that according to all the standards we use, we are technically bankrupt. Is it maybe better to face reality before it is too late? Is it maybe better for our nation to take the crunch immediately instead of continuously adding to our foreign debt, by implication borrowing more? Do we want to offer our children the hopeless conditions that many underdeveloped countries have had to offer their future generations? Do we want to be just another country that does not do anything other than pay off interest on foreign debts? What is the worst thing that could happen if we declare debt moratorium? Will the sky fall? Will we starve? Will we never again be able to get loans from the international community? Of course not. And then she goes through the various kinds of advice that have been offered. We have heard from many experts the horrendous tales of the International Monetary Fund. These experts warn us against continuing on the road we are on. Do these fine individuals know what they are talking about? One of them is a Nobel Prize winner in economics and has worked for the IMF for a long time. Another was an economic hitman, and yet another is a world-renowned economist. Some experts have proposed that we join other nations that have defied the International Monetary Fund, or at least seek advice from nations that have fared badly under IMF conditionalities. Will we be able to preserve economic independence if we continue to believe that the only possible solution to the debt problem is to create more debt? People who are dealing with excessive consumption of some sort should probably not use this cure, since the solution seems to consume so much more than the cure over the consumption. I don't understand this methodology. She goes on to say that if we continue to go on the current course, the Icelandic nation will be crushed under the interest burdens of foreign debt. Payment of foreign debt will take a big chunk of our economy and our GDP. The government proposes two ways out of the problem, slashing the welfare state and increasing taxes, and both of these are unacceptable. We'll have some more of this landmark, historic speech by Birgitte Jonsdottir to the All Thing when we come back here on World Crisis Radio.
This is Cascadia Public Radio.
Crisis Radio, Webster Tarpley reporting from Washington, D.C. Remember, go to the Russia Today website, and you'll find a five-minute interview with me from earlier this week about the CIA MI6 backing for Jundullah, the terrorist secret army aiming for an independent Balochistan under Salafi Sunni auspices, bad for the Iranian Persian Shiite government, bad for Pakistan, bad even for the tottering Karzai regime in Afghanistan. An independent Balochistan carves all of those. So go to Russia Today and look at that interview if you're interested. Also, remember the Fall of the Republic, the new Alex Jones Obama documentary, another landmark. This is part one of Fall of the Republic. I believe there's going to be a second installment at some point, but right now we have an excellent chance to see this Fall of the Republic. That's at InfoWars and InfoWars.com and PrisonPlanet.com. Also, take a look at Tarpley.net. Tarpley.net, you're going to see the ways to order the essential reading, Obama the Postmodern Coup, The Making of a Manchurian Candidate, Barack H. Obama, The Unauthorized Biography, and Surviving the Cataclysm, Your Guide to the Worst Financial Crisis in Human History. Take a look at Tarpley.net this week. We're upgrade the site. The upgrade is imminent, I would say, in the next week to 10 days. We will be transforming that site, making it much more up-to-date, and including commentaries on ongoing world events from day to day. So Tarpley.net, Tarpley.net, and you can order all the books through Tarpley.net. Let's go back now to the speech by Birgitta Jonsdottir in the Icelandic parliament. Again, this is a landmark. This is a heroic and history-making speech where a little country of 330,000 people stands up to the ogres, the bullies, the British with 60 million people, the Dutch with 10 million people or whatever they have, the European Commission with the Portuguese fascist Barroso at the head, and, of course, the International Monetary Fund of Dominique Strauss-Kahn, the would-be currency dictator of the world. So an answer comes from Reykjavik. Big countries are cowardly and dithering, as we hear, but the movement in the Icelandic parliament speaks a clear language. So they say the country will be crushed under debt and interest if they attempt to pay the foreign debt. We've got to make decisions based on hope, justice, and the resurrection of pride, and assert your national sovereignty, in effect. So we can and should seek all possible ways to find common solutions, but Britain has declared war on our nation when they labeled us as terrorists. The British authorities have used economic terrorism against us by misusing the IMF and using our European Union membership application as leverage to extort from us what they want to get in the way of money in the IceSave affair. It is morally wrong to lay debts on the shoulders of the public, which it had nothing to do with in the first place. These are private banking debts that the British and the Dutch want to collect from the Icelandic government. Our government doesn't seem to realize that we are indeed in an economic war and that the nation has been attacked in such a way which makes a courteous response impossible. It is impossible to say without blinking that we should pay the debts of financiers who mortgaged the work of the nation undisturbed while the administration slept. The demands of Britain and Holland regarding IceSave have to be rejected on the basis of national well-being and security. If the government tries to honor the IceSave agreement and follow the IMF program, this would lead to mass emigration out of Iceland, damage our health care and education system, diminish the workforce, inhibit productive investments, and usher in a period of permanent national decline. Birgitta Jonsdottir goes on, I object when our leaders claim that we the people are obliged to pay debts we never incurred. On what basis should every man, woman, and child in Iceland be forced to pay €20,000 each. That's $30,000. It's about half of what an average person might earn in a year if they're lucky, or more. I've heard that we have to pay the British and the Dutch because they are using their strong position to stop our loan from the IMF. I've heard members of Parliament say that the British and the Dutch were ruthless and rude to our visiting delegation last week in the European Parliament. And they said more than once that if we did not pay, we could not join the European Union. I don't know about you, says Birgitte Jones-Dottir, respected government and respected prime minister, but I think that the time has come to get out of this bind and to seek alternative solutions. So the action points. Birgitte Jones-Dottir, speaking for the movement, the faction in the Icelandic parliament, says, let's support the following ideas for action to bring us out of the economic calamity we are in. First, we should rid ourselves of the International Monetary Fund presence in our country using all available means. The European Union has also been hostile to Iceland in the Icesave debate, and hence it would be unadvisable to continue with our membership application at this time. Secondly, we should initiate measures to control speculative trading, first by placing a 1% Tobin tax on all financial transactions and profits, including derivatives, stocks, currency transactions, and commodity speculation. Additionally, we should halt the repossession of homes and businesses, stopping foreclosures in other words, and update our regulatory framework for banks and financial markets. So re-regulation, a Tobin tax, and in effect a stop on foreclosures. We are now heading into familiar territory where left and right are positioning themselves in the usual opposing trenches. The lament is now heard from a familiar corner about how the cutbacks are not large enough and it's unfair to tax those more who can afford to pay more. So this is an economic program with teeth, effective and hard-hitting to get Iceland out of this crisis. She talks about the role of the faction called the movement, the fruit of this, the distillation of the process of mass strikes, continuous demonstrations in November, December, January, into the springtime of this year. She talks about the fact that the executive branch is treating the parliament unfairly, keeping secrets, not distributing documents in the proper way. And concludes with a quotation from Halldór Laxness, the beloved Icelandic writer, Nobel Prize for Literature, 1955. We'll be back in just a minute on World Crisis Radio. Welcome back to World Crisis Radio, Webster Tarpley reporting from Washington, D.C. So there you have some excerpts from this landmark address concerning Iceland, the International Monetary Fund, debt moratorium, the Tobin tax, and related issues delivered by Birgitte Jones-Dottir of The Movement before the Icelandic Parliament in that crucial debate October 5th. 2009. This is political vision. This is a programmatic vision. This is eloquence. This is courage. This is initiative. This comes from a person who is not a professional politician, but indeed came into politics during that period of 3 to 4 months of continuous demonstrations, protests, and marches, and is now providing leadership where the exhausted parliamentary careerists who run the Icelandic government are incapable of taking a clear programmatic stand. And what she's got in this speech is already the basic form of what is necessary for Icelandic national salvation against the IMF, the British, and the Dutch. And I would call on listeners, especially in the United Kingdom and the Netherlands, let's open a front inside your countries in favor of Iceland. Stop the bullying of Iceland by the Anglo-Dutch government. lockstep alliance. Who wants to support the discredited policies of Gordon Brown and Miliband at the Foreign Office and the reactionary Balkanenda regime there in The Hague? So I would also urge people in the United States, here where the Americans are supposed to support the underdog in contests like this, it's time to find out where the local British consulate, British embassy is, Dutch consulate, Dutch embassy, other institutions, and stage a protest. Send in some letters, make some phone calls, make them understand that the American public does not sympathize with this incredible bullying, this blackmail, extortion, gangsterism, protection racket being attempted by the Anglo-Dutch against a small country which has done nothing to offend or harm anybody at the top of the world. True, there was a deregulated banking system, but nobody knew better than Gordon Brown that the British banking system had been savagely deregulated under Thatcher and Major, and he took it further. He knew what he was dealing with. So don't turn around and tell us that somebody else should pay for the British regulatory regime. Certainly pay those depositors. They'll hardly notice it. It's a pittance compared to all the money that has gone to Royal Bank of Scotland, Lloyds Bank, Northern Rock, and the rest of these zombie banks there in Britain. So lay off Iceland. The overriding U.S. interest in this is that there should be stability and normal conditions of economy and business and social life in Iceland. This is impossible if you try to extort one half of the gross domestic product. And let me add again, any notion of saying that Iceland will pay 6% of the future growth of the gross domestic product is a charade. This is a position of weakness, and it's going to end badly. Alan Garcia of Peru, 1985, offered to pay 10% of the foreign exchange earnings of Peru, and that was a failure. Sounded good. Sounded like it was a moderate or middle position. It turned out to be poison. It got him all the problems of a debt moratorium, but none of the benefits. He was paying money into a rat hole. He was paying the interest, which kept mounting up through banker's arithmetic in the background. It forced the imposition of domestic austerity, and ultimately it led to hyperinflation and to a dictatorship under Fujimori, along with other factors that contributed to that. So don't make Iceland go into hyperinflation and dictatorship, because who knows what comes out of that. Stability, solvency. Don't force Iceland to pay this debt, which has been invented. Again, the equivalent is if the British came to the United States with the Dutch tomorrow and said, guess what, you owe us $8 trillion because of some derivatives losses or something like that. What American would be willing to pay that? Nobody, I hope. But that's what they're trying to do to Iceland, coming and saying, guess what, you owe us one half of your GDP, $6 billion plus interest, at least 5.5%, and maybe more. We're now in the critical time for that. We're in the period of the next week or so, probably during the time this program is on the air. There's going to be some kind of a attempt by the British and the Dutch to ram that through the Icelandic parliament. So let's tell the Icelanders our best wishes. Hang tough. Don't pay. Go for a debt moratorium. Follow in the illustrious footsteps of great nations like Mexico, 1982, Brazil, 1987, Argentina, 2001. Argentina, in particular, under Rodriguez Saad and under Nestor Kirchner, cut the foreign debt by one half, and that's not bad. They got the IMF off their backs, and I think Iceland can do better because they have a better social safety net. And remember, they never signed for any of these debts. These debts have been completely invented by the gang in London and The Hague. So that's the Iceland update. Stay tuned for more. And again, as we upgrade Tarpley.net, that will be reflected there. In the meantime, you can find the full text of Birgitta Jones de Tir's speech at actindependent.org. It's up at the rents.com website and increasingly other sites around the internet. Now let's talk a little bit more about economics. The depression continues to deepen. The unemployment statistics this week, 550,000 new applications for jobless benefits. More than 500,000 people lost their job in the last week. That is a stunning reversal of the trend of that number, which had been down into the area of 300,000, 250,000, and so forth. It underlines the fact there is no recovery. There is no bottom. This is a bottomless world economic depression. No business cycle lifts you out of it. Nothing lifts you out of it. It comes in waves. We're now seeing the beginning of the second wave of this depression. Back in the 1930s, we had three waves, but we could have had more waves. And this time we're having a second one, but there's no guarantee that it will stop at three. Rather, there's a guarantee that if you don't change policies, if you don't dump the Austrian school and the Chicago school, you will have bottomless depression. And that means New Deal methods. New Deal, of course, brought up to date in the obvious ways. We'll talk about that later in the show. There is an uptick in home sales of 2%. This is probably because the special $8,000 tax credit for first-time homeowners is about to expire. That was a palliative measure at best. Remember, we are now between 21 and 25% real unemployment. A lot of people have exhausted their unemployment benefits. The jobless benefits extension bill is stalled in the Senate, blocked by reactionary Republicans, as usual, free marketeers who think that if you give somebody an unemployment check, that's communism, that's socialism, it's probably terrorism by now. So it's time to get the unemployment benefits extended. The other thing we've got is tremendous weakness in the U.S. dollar. In this past week, the dollar has broken through 75 on the dollar index, and the dollar is headed down, crashing through 75 on its way to 70. Right now, today, if you want to buy a euro, you've got to come up with 1.54 U.S. dollars. That is close to an all-time low. It is certainly a 14-month low. 14-month low against the euro, 14-month low on the dollar index. Now, this, of course, increases the danger that we'll kick over into some kind of a dollar panic, leading to hyperinflation, because that's how it happens. We'll be back in a minute.
America's number one source for independent talk radio for over a decade. We are the GCN Radio Network.
To World Crisis Radio. Now, we're taping our broadcast here on Friday, October 23rd, for the weekly briefing here. And Dow has taken a turn south, down 130 points, 1.3%, crashing back down through 10,000. The jitters are certainly there, some jitters in Asia this week as well. Has to do with the dollar. You've got this dollar-Dow trade-off going. The idea is the dollar crashes down. That means that program traders from abroad, from Europe, Japan, and so forth, can come in and snap up some U.S. stocks at depressed prices. Don't look at the market price. Look at the market price deflated by the dollar value, because if the dollar goes down, that cuts into what this is really worth on a world scale, and that has been going poorly lately. So the dollar weakness, it adds up to oil approaching $82 a barrel at various times this week. Oil up more than 10% in the last 7 or 8 days or so. That's quite a spike. Gold remains up at the 1050, 1060 level. Dollar very weak. And here's the problem. All these talking heads on the financial networks are telling you that the dollar weakness doesn't matter. Don't worry about it. Who cares? Problem is that as the dollar goes down, that does help to drive the price of oil up. That drives gasoline up, and that means that the U.S. consumer, and we're always told that's two-thirds of this very sick economy. Any economy where consumer spending is two-thirds is already quite sick capital goods should be much bigger in a healthy economy. But since this is what we have, if you've got two-thirds of the economy based on consumer spending and the price of gasoline is now headed up, 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 this will cut into disposable consumer income. And that means more credit card defaults, more home foreclosures, more problems of that sort, pulling down the banking system. So you get the idea. These things are interconnected. The dollar weakness tends to undermine the entire thing. Now, the situation, therefore, resembles a tremendous buildup of snow on the side of a mountain. The potential for an avalanche is there. A firecracker, a gunshot, a loud scream perhaps could set it off. So who's going to provide that? Anybody could. But look at somebody like George Soros and his British allies. We remind you of the very interesting article by Vlad Grinkevich, Ria Novosti, 10 days ago, pointing to the Robert Fisk article in The Independent and wondering if that was a plant by George Soros and his speculator friends to get a downward pop in the dollar and make some short-term speculative profits. That, of course, is Soros's modus operandi. 1992, 33% devaluation of the pound caused by Soros leading the pack of hedge fund hyenas, and Soros essentially robbed every man, woman, and child in the British Isles of a 20-pound note. So that's what he does. Robert Fisk, in the orbit of British intelligence, the old MICAS in Beirut, right, the Middle East Center for Arab Studies, British intelligence branch of the British Arab Bureau there in Beirut, George Soros calling the shots. You get the picture. So look for the British to be the vandals. Look for them to attempt to precipitate the crisis. That's what they did in 1931 when the pound defaulted on gold, September 1931, destroyed the existing monetary system. Same thing in 1971, 40 years later. British demand $3 billion of the U.S. in gold, and that pushes Nixon into the incalculable folly of abolishing Bretton Woods. You can read about these things in Surviving the Cataclysm, Your Guide to the Worst Financial Crisis in Human History. And then 2008, the Lehman Brothers panic. Remember, it was Barclays Bank that posed as a buyer of Lehman during that Lehman Brothers weekend in the middle of September of last year, until at the very last moment when there was no time left to find an alternative solution and Tokyo was about to open, the British regulator, somebody who had never been heard of by anybody, came out of the woodwork and said, no, you can't buy Lehman Brothers. So that meant that Lehman Brothers was pitched into bankruptcy instead of being bailed out in the way that J.P. Morgan Chase had bailed out Bear Stearns back in March. So perfide Albion, always on the march. And notice that when that Robert Fisk article came out, you had all sorts of people, Al Jazeera, heavy with British intelligence, and Drudge going crazy, and some other unfortunate commentators were sucked into cheerleading for what was in effect a ploy by, most likely a ploy, by hedge fund operators, hedge fund hyenas, acting in synergy with Soros or somebody like Soros. So the dollar crisis continues. Now, people say, oh, there's deflation. I don't see how you can seriously believe there's deflation in the U.S. The official estimates are between 1 and 5% deflation in the U.S. in the past year. Most of this has to do with the falling price of oil and therefore gasoline. That has turned around in the meantime. But remember, the market basket used for the consumer price index at the Labor Department is a fake because it doesn't represent what you need to buy in order to live. Doesn't have insurance, doesn't have medical care, doesn't have college expenses that people can be paying in any age bracket if they have young children, grandchildren, whatever it is. So it's a fraud. And the idea that there shouldn't be a cost of living escalator in Social Security, the reactionaries are now coming out and ranting against Obama. Obama wants to give a miserable $250 to senior citizens on Social Security. And George Will says, oh, no, this is the end all. This is just horrible. This is communism, of course. Because in reality, $250 gets you nowhere. And the point is, it's not the case that there's been deflation. The cost of living has continued to go up, up, up. It's just that since Michael Boskin and some other fakers in the Bush the Elder administration fixed the Social Security index, this has been incapable, even less capable of reflecting real economic changes than it had been before. We also have the big controversy about bonuses. Oh, yes. The zombie banks and some other corporations that have been bailed out by the federal government, we now have the pay czar coming out, Kenneth R. Feinberg, the pay czar, saying that they've got to cut their golden parachutes and their bloated bonuses by 90%. Okay, so you've got Limbaugh on the air, right? Limbaugh, always eager to defend oligarchical privilege, is out there screaming bloody murder that you can't do that, and the privileges of these finance oligarchs are sacrosanct. And, of course, if they get a finance oligarch, they may come after you. Well, we're told that these are contracts, that contracts are inviolable. Hey, wait a minute. The UAW had contracts with General Motors and with Chrysler. What happened to those contracts? They were torn up. Now, naturally, the UAW participated, unfortunately, in this wretched process of allowing these things to be torn up. But still, labor contracts with hundreds of thousands of blue-collar workers are worth nothing. But labor contracts with finance oligarchs in Wall Street are, of course, sacrosanct. Here's the problem. If you look at the list of companies, these are now only certain banks and large firms that still have money from the TARP, from the bailout. So who's on the list? Seven companies. Citigroup, Pandit the Bandit, of course. Good that they're on there. Bank of America, Lewis, the oligarchical spokesman in some ways. But then we go to General Motors, Chrysler, General Motors Acceptance Corporation, Chrysler Financial, and American International Group, AIG. Now, AIG deserves to be on there more than anybody else. They have cost the U.S. taxpayer almost $200 billion because of that $3 trillion of derivatives at their London hedge fund. But the problem is, where's Goldman Sachs? Where's J.P. Morgan? Where's Wells Fargo? Where's Bank of New York Mellon? We want all of them. Morgan Stanley, get them on the list. Cut their bonuses, too. This is a half measure. It's a fig leaf. Back in a minute.